Hello, how are you?
Good morning. I'm thrilled to talk to you. I've been so excited since I've had the pleasure of talking to so many incredible women this year who've written amazing books, and you are one of them.
Awesome.
I'd love to introduce my guest. It's Ami Kwerekone, and she is the incredible author of a few books, but this one we're going to focus on today, among many other things. A fantastic title, The Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business, What Every Woman Needs to Know to Be a Courageous, Authentic, and Unstoppable Entrepreneur. I mean, rush over to Amazon or Barnes & Noble right now. I mean, with a title like that, do we really need to say anything more?
I appreciate that.
Ami is a business and leadership coach, and she's been an entrepreneur herself since 2002 when she founded her first company in Seattle. And I think she might have ended up in Seattle a little bit because of the music, because this woman has a bit of a punk rock thing going on.
Yeah, that's actually true. I totally sat down with a map as I was graduating from college, and Seattle was the coolest city in the world in, you know, 1995. So I was drawn definitely here for that.
Now, you actually moved to Seattle with an engineering degree, and now you're a kick-ass activity girl coach. I've got a question about that. But you were an engineer, then you got your master's degree in environment and community. I mean, you were working with fire stations, conservation offices and planning departments, with sustainable building advisors. So you were ahead of the game. Sustainable, I think, wasn't even really a word back in the 90s. But how did you get from there to inventing a recycled content building material something in your garage?
Well, it actually was connected to the sustainability work that I was doing. The city of Seattle was one of the first cities in the United States to adopt green building standards. So it really wasn't commonplace to talk about sustainable design practices, at least in the U.S. and not at a required level. And while I was in the process of working in engineering, I had started taking an advisor certificate program, and I just kept coming up with all these questions. And my instructor, just this fabulous woman named Kathleen O'Brien, had suggested that I should go get into the master's program at Antioch University on Environment and Community, because it was this intersectional study of people and our relationship to policies and the environment and economics and government and, I mean, just all of the stuff. And while I was in that program, one of my economics classes, you know, we were looking at a book called Going Local, and it was about import substitution, which was taking a look at our communities, see how many things we buy that are actually manufactured outside of the community. And so we're sending our dollars outside and we're never recirculating them within our own community and supporting our own local businesses. And so I took that paper and I totally went for overachievement mode on it. And I decided that because I worked in building construction and design and architecture, that I would look at building materials, because it's quite common we buy building materials manufactured outside of our community, supporting other businesses. And this idea for a locally manufactured product developed off of an idea called Papercrete, which is just a mix of newspapers and water and cement and some sand. And I thought, if you could make that commercially viable, you know, something that actually was attractive enough to be a legitimate building material, all the materials could be sourced within a bioregion. And if it was using the recycled paper, could come from that community itself. And so I did this paper, I wrote it as a business plan. And then I thought, if this really is such a great idea, then somebody should do it, you know? And so I thought, I'll be that person. Like, I'll investigate this. You know, I don't like, you know, coming up with theories and not seeing it through to making it, you know, something that could actually happen. And so it was the magic of an idea I couldn't get out of my head. And so while I was finishing up my degree and I was a consultant, you know, doing sustainable policy development, I was going out in my garage and experimenting. And then suddenly I came up with something that seemed to be suitable to make its way into specifications for buildings. And that's how it all started. But it was, I don't know why it stuck, but it did. And I'm grateful for it, because it was an awesome, 10 years of my life doing all that.
Ami can not only get you from a garage to launching your business, she can also get you from a kitchen table. So if you're sitting there with an idea for a business at your kitchen table, reach out to this woman, because she will also get you from kitchen table to, which brings me to your next business, you went to from the table to your backyard. One of the books you published, which is also a great name, Turn Your Rural Property into a Wedding Venue Business. Tell me about that venture.
Well, I always wanted to be a writer. So doing all this engineering and inventing and stuff like that, like I was an engineer my whole life. I'm the kid who tore apart stereos and built tree houses and all that. So that wasn't like a huge departure for me. But I also had a passion for writing. And, you know, I had found myself at some point during my career, you know, in a relationship with a gentleman who was trying to rent a property out and do wedding venues. And where I live in the Seattle area, in this rural section, it's a very great destination for rural weddings. And he was wanting to get involved in it. And I was in between the manufacturing business and life and sitting there thinking, well, why don't I just see if I can't take over this wedding business thing and see what I can do with that. And yeah, turned that into 2 6-figure wedding venues, award-winning, popular. At one wedding, we actually had Bill Gates and his family in attendance. So it's like, holy cow. I mean, so that was huge. But the writing part was really strong for me. And so I decided that I wanted to learn the world of self-publishing. And I figured the best way to do that is pick a subject that I can write about with my eyes closed, you know, and I knew that there was a demand, at least because people would always come up to me at the weddings and ask me, like, how do you do this? Like, how would I do this on my own property? So I knew there was at least, you know, a dozen people that would want to buy the book. but it was really an intention to again, learn the mechanics of self-publishing and not be overwhelmed by the content and be able to just focus on how do you bring a book to market if you're going to do it yourself. And then lo and behold, this little book comes out and I, you know, it's been steady, like for 5 years. It's like, right now, like in the top 100,000 titles, it's been there for, again, 5 years on Amazon, which is like 10 million titles out there. And I'm just always surprised, you know, it sells probably, I think it's the average is like 1 to 2 copies every day since I published it in 2016. So.
Wow. What an achievement. And it really speaks to the fact that you found a fantastic niche. And as I heard you say, you wrote about what you could write about in your sleep. Like you were an expert in that matter and you transformed that into content. I'm going to circle to something slightly off center, but you are known as the activity girl. Where did that come from? I mean, I'm on your website. It's a fantastic website under Amiri's name, and that's AmiriQuiriconi.com. There'll be a link in the show notes. Fantastic. Ami has a definite love of black. I love her black and white. Great design ethos here. And we're going to be talking about how she brings black into her clothing and why she sent me a photo of her with her foot towards the camera. But where did Activity Girl come from?
Well, Activity Girl is a Joan Jett song. It was, she published it back. Yeah. So this is my punk rock roots. She actually wrote it about the lead singer of Bikini Kill, Kathleen Hanna, when Kathleen Hanna was a student at Evergreen College down here in Olympia, Washington, and during the Riot Girl music movement of the 1990s. And so it's about an activist, you know, it's about a young woman who, you know, balances her creative pursuits and punk rock music with actually spreading the word and teaching people about the ills in society and what we can all do better. And so I heard the song, you know, live version of it way back when I moved up to Seattle, and, you know, it came out, I think, in 92 or 93, and I heard it in like 95. And I was just like, that's me. Like, that's who I've always been. I've always been, you know, fueled by, you know, anger, but anger towards injustice. And that has always been my inspiration and my motivation to do something. And so when I started blogging while doing my manufacturing business, that was Activity Girl was the nickname of my blog. And so then when I decided to actually start my second consulting practice in 2017, it felt like that was the name I needed to go with, because that is really at the heart of who I am. It's, you know, my consulting and coaching business is paired with speaking out on behalf of the things we need to be worried about, like mental health and business and toxic workplace and all this stuff. And so, yeah, but it's a song, the spelling's slightly different because it's Riot Girl there's no I in it. There's always an R, but nobody would know that if they weren't into the Riot Girl scene. So I had to modify the spelling a bit. And I actually have a poster on my wall over my desk from Joan Jett autographed when I told her that I had named my business after her song. And so I got her like official blessing and I hang it up over my head to remind me that, like, yeah, even Joan Jett said it was cool. So.
Oh, wow. Give me a minute while I just go into fangirl mode. Joan Jett. The amount of times I sung I Love Rock and Roll in a karaoke bar in Tokyo and over again. I dyed my hair black for that woman. So having a sign poster, wow. Please put a photo of that on your website. That's truly, that really needs be up there. You spoke a lot about anger towards justice. What a powerful message. I know on your website, you talk about psychological safety is an important feature in companies that thrive. I also want to talk to you about CPTSD, but would you mind telling us a little bit about what is psychological safety and why is that so important in a company environment?
Yeah, well, psychological safety is a place where you feel like you're free from any of your traumas or triggers from being activated. And, you know, psychological safety is the experiencing trust, you know, sincere feelings of trust with people around you, feeling connected and validated and belonging. And any time you don't have those things, then we sense that in our bodies and in our emotional well-being is that we don't feel safe there. We feel like we can't be ourselves. We can't speak up. We get triggered sometimes by the behaviors of people that are more negative or punishing or, you know, invalidating or, you know, there's a variety of experiences that many people can relate to in their workplace. But when we talk about being in a place of psychological safety, again, it means that your flight, you know, your sympathetic nervous system is not being activated on a consistent basis. You're not in fight or flight mode several times a day because of where you work, because of the people you work with or the supervisors you have on your team, or even the customers that you have to deal with on a regular basis. And it's important because, you know, we spend so much time, you know, with our work experience and our work life experience that, you know, we are only human beings, you know, and that doesn't make us perfect. That makes us amazing and imperfect. And when our work experiences are unsafe in that way and we're triggered and activated, that has to ventilate somewhere. And unfortunately, what we've learned in culture is we can't ventilate that at work or we lose our job. And if we lose our job, we can't pay for things we need. So we violate our ability to satisfy our base needs. And so where do we ventilate that out? At home, at our families, our friends, and sometimes against ourselves through addiction, self-harm, or we hold it in our bodies and our health is affected by it. And so for me, my mission of having been a mental health advocate for several years is I believe that if we really want to kind of embrace our communities and make us healthier all around and reduce the impacts of, you know, one thing for me is childhood trauma. We have to think about all the parents and the adults that go to work every day and to work with leaders and organizations to figure out how to reduce the trauma that's actually being shared through the work, you know, the work culture.
You say it's very important to start with the tip of the spear. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, trust comes from authority, you know, in the sense that if the tip of the spear in the case of companies, it's the leaders, the owners, if they are not involved and there's not a sincere and heartfelt effort to make these kinds of changes and to behave in ways that foster psychological safety with their company and their employees and their customers, you're never going to build enough trust through the system for it to be sustainable and long lasting. And I've seen this in companies where, you know, a human resources team or a manager is really in and ready to be the best that they can be for the employees, but it can quickly be eroded and undermined by the swift actions of a leader who thinks it's a waste of time, or they, you know, they don't think it applies to them and they still think they have carte blanche at being able to yell and scream and posture and, you know, do whatever other old, you know, outdated leadership tropes that some people hold on to. And so for me, it's like, I want to start, and I do start with like everybody at the very beginning, because we are used to taking cues from people in authority. We learned our skills from our parents, good and bad, teachers, community leaders, spiritual leaders. And so if we can transform leaders in organizations to be a new model for what they want and the kind of culture they want to nurture and cultivate, it will actually translate through the organization far better than it does from the bottom up.
I'm making notes as I'm listening. You're just blowing me away. You were generous that you shared that you have experienced CPTSD. Would you mind explaining what that is?
Yes. So it's complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And it is the result of complex trauma. There's usually five buckets of types of trauma that people experience in their lives. And the one that most people are familiar with are like acute traumas, like a devastating accident, a mugging, you know, a natural disaster, you know, things like that. And then there's things like chronic trauma that people can experience, like if they live in neighborhoods, you know, that have a lot of violence in the neighborhoods, or they've experienced bullying and racism and other forms of discrimination. situation. But complex trauma is a category of trauma where what you're dealing with is your support system, your caregivers, your, you know, your parents, your close families are the source of your trauma. And it's called complex in simple terms because your protectors are also your perpetrators. And it can leave a lot of very confusing results in our minds and our bodies, especially as children. So imagine growing up with emotionally neglectful parents, growing up with abusive parents, maybe not growing up with parents at all, living in the foster system. And so those forms of traumas, then depending on if within that you actually experienced traumatic events. In the case of me, it was an abandonment at 5 years old, and then not receiving the follow-up care and support in order to help my system re-regulate and feel safe again. Well, then those become these can be, you know, ongoing. And so CPTSD is actually something that is commonly found in people that have dealt with abusive or abandonment or other, you know, forms of neglect as they've been growing up on a repetitive basis, not just a one-time thing, but something that has been woven into their entire childhood experience. And so what it can do to you is create these triggers in you that are completely appropriate to have as a child when you're trying to survive. But then as an adult can actually be completely misunderstood in the context of like work or personal relationships or friendships or even within your own family. And so identifying if you have CPTSD can be really helpful because it can help you maybe start to make sense of these out of context responses because we're being triggered or re-traumatized by something that, you know, wouldn't affect another person. Does that make sense?
Completely and utterly. I was wondering how many people don't have trauma. I'm thinking it's probably quite a small amount. You said it was a personal transformations, and as part of this journey to which you can now speak so eloquently about and be of such service through your experience, but there was a personal transformation that spurred you to create your podcast, One Broken Mom, which is such a bold and powerful and vulnerable title. Would you tell me about your podcast?
Yes, thank you. Well, it came about, you know, part of this anger spurring on action. You know, my anger is how I express love. You know, I've said that before, like, you know, my anger isn't fueled by hatred, it's fueled by love. And in 2017, after, you know, re-experiencing another loss of businesses, another loss of personal relationship, my children, you know, I was a single parent with two teenagers, and I knew that I was a common denominator in, you know, some of the most terrible things that had happened to my life. And I was finding myself in a place of taking accountability for that. And I realized in 2017 in December that if I didn't really start to understand and unravel what was going on, that I was going to victimize my kids. And I was already in the process of doing that because of just by virtue of being unaware of what was really happening at the neuroscience level, the neurobiology level. You know, how does trauma affect our brain and our emotional responses and triggers and all that stuff? And I remember it had taken me several months to get to that place in December. Lots of books, lots of white papers. You know, I was reading everything. It was like I was in a rabbit hole and chasing it all down. It's actually, it looked more like an ant farm. If you've ever seen an ant farm where there's just a million little shoots. But by 2017, I was sitting there, you know, December, I realized I needed to change because a light, you know, this click literally went off in my head. No, not literally, but it's how it felt. Like I had a moment of seeing exactly what I needed to do and how I needed to do it and why. And it was, you know, and then realizing that I needed to go to therapy right away. And I did for months, and I went weekly to be able to unpack and start to heal the parts that had been affected by the CPTSD, the traumatic events, things that I thought I was strong enough that I'd overcome, but clearly they were still like involved, heavily involved in my life and my decisions. And I realized how hard that was. And I had actively pursued this knowledge. And I thought, man, there, I wish I could make this easier for some people. And so the idea for One Broken Mom came about because I thought, well, what if I can take everything I've been learning and I can just be a part of a community and make it accessible to people, do the research, do the reading, do all that stuff, synthesize it, bring in these people that have written these books that changed my life, talk to them on the air and ask the questions that I know every, you know, other people are thinking of asking, but don't know who to ask. And so that's where the show came from. And it became a part of my therapeutic journey, because again, I was looking at myself and I was in real time working through things. And then there were, you know, there's a bountiful amount of resources that people don't think to reach out to. And that's okay. I'm the type of person that will. And I figured that that's where, you know, I can contribute to the global conversation about mental health in a way that's authentic to me, which is to be able to, you know, to be curious and rebellious and talk to these, you know, these amazing people and then broadcast it for free to the world, to be able to have and have access to it to help them, you know, get them, you know, a few steps further in their own journey.
Ami's podcast is an incredible resource. Now, she balances candor with boldness. You can tell this woman is fearless and curious and rebellious and bold, but also funny. So there is humor in these podcasts as well. And the topics that you have, this is an incredible resource library, financial impacts of divorce on women, boundary violations, becoming unstoppable, becoming assertive. And one that really spoke to me was careers that kill, that there are careers that have a higher level of suicide. Would you feel comfortable speaking to that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, and it, because it's important to me, you know, on my show, it's about self-improvement, parenting and mental health. But, you know, I always classify this, you don't have to be a parent to listen to my show. Cause I actually don't talk as much about how to be a parent as much as how to understand how parenting affected us, which in turn then influences how we parent. So it's all connected. So, when I also speak, I'm also trying to bring balance to the topics. And so careers that kill, you know, the top jobs in the United States with the highest rates of suicide happen to be male dominated fields, blue collar fields, construction, manufacturing, agriculture, mining and resources, trucking, transportation. And as a mother of a son, as well as a daughter, also having spent, you know, about half of my professional career in the blue collar fields that are heavily male dominated, and seeing that the largest group of deaths by suicide in the United States occur in men my age, the Gen X, you know, 40 to 55 years old, growing, and it's an astronomically higher number. You know, I can't do mental health and not actually make sure to pinpoint the places in which, again, if I go back to workplace culture and how we can change culture, we can literally save lives, especially in certain industries, because the industries when I've worked in them usually lack support. They lack the language and a comfort with being able to address mental health. And when you look at the data, then the data supports it that the absence of that can be killing people, in particular men in the United States. And so I think it's really important to, you know, to bring a, you know, awareness of not only our personal skills, but just what's going on out in the world, because we don't really talk about suicide and suicide prevention a lot, for fear of it being too triggering for some people, because it is, it's an extremely devastating condition. But more people die by their own hands in the United States than actually are murdered. and so, I mean, by a lot. And so I think it's always important to be able to talk about it. And, you know, and if you then take a look at which careers have the higher levels, you're also really looking at, again, the demographic that is most concerning for me, which is, you know, middle-aged men, you know, in the United States. And we all matter, you know, and we all have different grooming and gender norming that has hurt all of us, from women to men to, you know, people, you know, non-binary even. And those things have also contributed to, you know, mental health and decline and lack of ability of or comfort with being able to get support, you know.
And as you said, as the mother of a son and a daughter, I'm struggling to be as articulate as you. I'm blown away by your eloquence, but to not have a conversation about mental health and include both genders does us all a disservice. So thank you for speaking to that. I'm going to segue into something completely and utterly different. You have the most incredible wearable art. You have beautiful tattoos. Would you tell us about those?
Oh yeah, I do. And that's a great segue. I mean, cause I was expecting to talk about some fashion here too. So I'm excited. Yeah, my tattoos are, you know, I started getting them when I moved out to Seattle in 95, and I've always treated my tattoos as statements and testaments of where I am in life. And you know, I, as an entrepreneur, I also kind of buck the system of, you know, you can't be a boss and have tattoos, you know, that old, you know, mindset back then. I was like, you know what, as long as I'm my own boss and I show up, and I'm intelligent and I do what my customers need from me and my vendors need from me, they're not going to care after a while that I have tattoos all over my arm. And it also just made me feel like it was one way of expressing my authenticity. So I've got like my big sleeve on my one arm is the Queen of Hearts. And she's representative. I call her my dark woman. She's representative of the parts of me that really did struggle with relationships. And I'm okay with her like living there, you know, as that reminder of, sometimes we can behave in ways that, you know, are not great for our own personal well-being. And I think that when you go through dealing with healing trauma, and if it's affected you pretty dramatically and in certain situations, you know, we don't need to relive any of that, but she's there, you know, as a part of a big period of my life. And then I've got my kids tattooed on my arms. They're represented by a wizard and a little dragon. And they're pretty fun. And then on my leg, I've got a Buddhist tattoo that I got after I graduated with my master's degree in environment community to remind me of the kind of woman to be. And it's Green Tara. And so if you look up Green Tara, she represents active compassion. So she is basically the Buddhist form of an activity girl. And so that's a big piece that I have on my right leg. So.
And speaking of legs, you sent me a great photo with your foot basically right in front of the camera. And you said, this is my professional outfit usually. I'll let you know that Ami has a kick-ass sense of fashion. There's a strong hint of black. I can totally see the punk, the rebellious coming through in her own personal statement, her own personal style. But were they Converse? What did you have on my face? What was that?
They are my weatherproof Converse. So for most people, you think of like just canvas high tops or low tops when you think of Chuck Taylors, Converse Chuck Taylors. But when you live in the Seattle area and you have like 7 months of rain and puddles everywhere, it's, you know, sometimes you have to upgrade. And so those are my winter versions of Converse that I wear when I don't want to get my feet soaking wet outside.
Oh, can we circle back to your one of you as an author, the book that I really want to talk about right now, The Fearless Woman's Guide. Oh, and I want to hear about your Fearless Women's workshops as well. But just speaking about the book, The Fearless Woman's Guide. Now, this is unusual. The cover is pink. This is a woman who rocks black, who has Joan Jett on her wall, who has these beautiful, intense, wearable art tattoos. And yet the cover of the book, is that pink?
Yeah, it's pink. And I, you know, to be honest, the publisher went with that, but I approved it. Like we did have some other options on it. And, you know, pink is this gender norm color and it's a color I rejected. I mean, outwardly rejected my whole life. And a lot of that had to do with feelings I had about not feminism, but of the role I was expected to play, you know, that got in the way of my authenticity. So I hated pink. My daughter never wore pink. I just felt like if I showed up in pink, that I was telling everybody what to expect for me. And I always hated everybody being able to think they knew me without actually knowing me. I mean, it just all of that stuff. But to bring a book out, there was this, in order to get to the place where I could write a book that was focused on women, I had to understand, you know, the ways in which gender norming impacted me and held me back negatively. But also I had to really examine my relationship with women because, again, I intentionally went into blue collar careers because I felt psychologically safer around men and the absence of emotion in decisions, you know, which, you know, I know now is like, that's not a good thing. Right. And so I, you know, my career, when I went into the wedding industry, well, that's a pink collar career, meaning that it's predominantly female oriented. And in fact, the customer orientation for many decades has been towards brides and moms and bridesmaids, and that grooms and groomsmen have always been like a side effect. Then of course, with marriage equality, that changed that substantially. But it's still, you know, a lot of the vendors and the people that work in that field are women. And once I found myself working directly in constant contact with a lot more women than I'd ever had in my whole life, I began to then actually see, again, what the gender norming, you know, how it hurts. I got to see the behaviors of a lot of the women that I worked with that I write about in that book, you know, the learned habits and feelings and beliefs around money and leadership and communication that actually undermine women's abilities to earn as much as men, to, you know, stay out of poverty, especially after going through divorce and separations, and have the confidence level to be able to negotiate and be assertive, but also know that there are backlashes for when women behave assertively in business and how to navigate those as the world starts to, you know, become better educated and less caveman, you know, with their beliefs about what women can or should or, you know, can't do, you know, when it comes to professional, you know, exploits and stuff. So yeah, Pink was there to highlight it. And also, you know, that was also an act of rebellion against my own past beliefs that were actually negative at times about, you know, working with women or being around women, because my CPTSD was related to conflict with my mother, and my mother became an embodiment of women. And unfortunately, that then was a trauma response to avoid them at all costs. And so when I healed all that and could come back into it, then it allowed me to not have that negativity around it.
I am the opposite. I don't feel safe around men. Which is part of the reason I started this podcast, was I wanted to make sure that I spoke to women every single week. I really wanted to build up my female community. And look, I need to let you know I'm struggling a little right now. I've got a brain fog. I suffer. Well, suffer's not the right word for it. I have bipolar. I'm a bit foggy this morning. So I am having trouble forming sentences. But what you are saying is having such a profound impact. I really appreciate everything you're sharing. In Ami's book, every woman needs to know to be a courageous, authentic, and unstoppable entrepreneur. And if you're like me, you like to listen to books while you're walking the dog. It's audiobooks, Audible, Bookshop, Amazon. You help entrepreneurs combine business with authentic. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, when you see me, you see that I am who I am. And I've been this way for many years, and I've led it into my businesses. Like, when I started my companies, part of the reason for starting my companies was so that I could be exactly who I am. And because who I am is perfectly fine and wonderful. And I, you know, feel really good about my contributions, you know, to the community and the world. And there's no reason I need to change that. But that's not a belief system that many women have. And, you know, sometimes men do deal with that themselves. But it's really important that sometimes we get into entrepreneurship and businesses because we're trying to solve immediate pains or suffering that we have in our life. And we may end up traveling down paths that sound like they're good solutions to solve a current pain, but they may not be a real good expression of what we'd rather be doing. And, you know, people haven't really been given permission to dream about what they'd rather be doing instead, except for, I will say this, coming out of a pandemic where a lot of people were, and especially women, you know, almost 3 million women left the workforce or were forced out of the workforce because of the pandemic. So there are a lot of women that are thinking, if I come back, how can I come back differently? And so it is a really good time for the self-reflection of what kind of business or what kind of professional activity would I create if I had to start from scratch? And so the book is a way in which to be able to work through, you know, how to come to those decisions. But most importantly, I integrate into it the mental health and the neuroscience of how our brains actually become in the operating system that we use and the skills that we should have been shown. But as you said, I wonder how many people suffer, you know, have trauma. Well, there's enough research out there to show that there's at least 50% of us have experienced one form of trauma and dysfunction before the age of 18. And there's about 20% of us have experienced four or more significant events that dramatically affect our health and outcomes in life, socially as well as workplace. And so the book is really an ability to unpack that for everybody to get reflective about where those experiences may be, and then to be able to learn how to overcome them and then apply them directly into their businesses in ways that maybe get them to rethink, you know, their next venture into entrepreneurship if they're going to start again, or their first venture into entrepreneurship.
Ami also has an amazing guide. Jump on her website. There is a free ebook, because this woman is a writer, which, hey, how's your hand? Didn't you break your hand?
I did. Yes, I did break my finger playing softball this summer. And so it looks like it's healing, but I still have to wear a splint for another 4 weeks. So I'll be in it until the end of the year, but at least I can start some physical therapy and get that finger using again. But it's my right hand, and so it has really messed up my typing the last several months.
Expectation software. This is where Dragon comes into its own. Back to ebooks, this fantastic free gift. It's an ebook, What You Should Be Earning, and I love this part of it, based on your dreams and aspirations, which makes It's so personal and brings it back to what you want to achieve in life. I thought that was a beautiful way of wording it. And that free e-guide, which is available on Ami's website. Ami also does these incredible workshops, speaking about one of them is getting paid what you're worth. And that's a 4-hour workshop, which you are able to offer virtually. Do you offer that to groups or individuals or?
A bit of both. So sometimes it is worked into a coaching package with a client. So it's done individually. You know, lots of people come to business coaching for a variety of reasons. And I do clarify, like, I'm not a life coach. I have a lot of life experiences, but, and we're whole people, right? So business and life aren't always separated from each other. But, you know, a lot of the clients that I do work with from coaching have like a business thing that they're trying to solve. And then we solve that and also look at what are the habits and skills that maybe we need to develop concurrent with that in order to be able to get the outcome. So it can be integrated into coaching is like, that's really what I want to focus on is on my value, my worth, and what I want and how I want to build my business. And then sometimes like I'll be doing a short version of it at, for the Global Entrepreneurship Month in November. It'll be offered on an online webinar, free webinar that the state of Washington is actually hosting. So they have speakers coming in from around the state. And so it gets kind of pieced up. I don't have any on the books right now scheduled for online, but because I am in the States and because Zoom is pretty popular for everybody and people know how to use it and I have coaching clients around the world, being able to do it as a webinar is an option, especially for there's a group out there that actually would like to, you know, to bring it to their community.
Ami is a great speaker, obviously, and also a great trainer. One of her other workshops, Communicating with Confidence. Who do you find really benefits from the, why did you create this workshop and was it targeted for any particular business people in particular?
Yeah, you know, my experience, especially in the pink collar fields, is really witnessing a lot of women that have really wonderful businesses, but they don't know how to talk about their businesses. They feel, you know, they lack the networking experience and confidence. They lack the ability, like I'm sitting here on a microphone, like I've been training as a speaker literally since high school. So this isn't something that, you know, it doesn't come with practice. And so when people have difficulty with assertive communication, feel really uncomfortable with speaking with somebody, they, you know, they are fearful. And I've met a lot of women that literally get anxiety, you know, with the idea of being able to bring up and have difficult discussions, either with their clients, with their employees, with their partners, their friends, whatever. They can benefit from this type of a workshop because it focuses on learning why we have difficulties with communication, where that comes from. And it's a learned habit that comes from usually our families of origin and the habits and styles we adopted in order to integrate into whatever dysfunction our family had. And even if you're a confident woman, like I worked in the blue collar field and I preferred a direct form of communication, I still found some of the gender norming getting in my way when it came into negotiations. And so if you find that, you know, it you get butterflies in your stomach when you have to talk about a lot of things, you know, taking a, you know, having this be a focus either in coaching or in a workshop can really be beneficial for you.
Fearless Women's Workshops. In the last few years, I've been hearing the word mompreneur. Is this a harmful or a helpful term? And what do you think it means? How would you describe a mompreneur?
You know, I never really like to judge the words that people choose to use and identify with. I think that there's a slippery slope because it's really a matter of opinion, right? and so I know that people that identify themselves as mompreneurs are, you know, I would be one of those. You know, I'm a single mom. I have kids. You know, a mompreneur is typically, in my opinion, somebody who is doing a lot of free household labor as well as running a business at the same time. And so, you know, and that is a reality for many women in the United States, especially if they have families, that they actually are working two jobs. And one of them is mom and one of them is the career of choice, you know, whatever that may be. Harmful, you know, I know that there's some people that really believe that, you know, we have to stop gender norming the words like, you know, female boss and fempreneur and all that. But there are people that gain empowerment from those terms. And I'm okay with them. If that fuels them and they and that that's how they feel good identifying with that, I'm not going to take that away from them or shame them for choosing that word. So good or bad, I prefer not to weigh in on an opinion, you know, of that. I think it can be harmful if it's used as a microaggression. And a microaggression is when somebody is using it to tease you or to put you down or to lower your status. So if like a man were to call you a female boss, well, that might be harmful because that feels like that's a microaggression. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I've come across words over the last few years like neurodivergent, which have I found incredibly empowering because it was like, oh, thank you. Something I can relate to, something I can use to describe things so that other people can understand. So yay for mompreneur if you identify with that and that helps bring you to a place where you feel that you are not isolated, you're not alone, and that you can find other people like yourself. That's absolutely fantastic because we need people who've had similar experiences and who can share what we're going through. Mm-hmm. You did a fantastic talk on SheOwnsIt.com where you talk about getting out of the side hustler mindset. What's a side hustler mindset?
Well, you know, not to shame side hustles because everybody's got them, right? Mm-hmm. But the side hustler mindset really can be an opinion that you have of your business that it's never going to be able to turn into a full-time position, or that you don't believe that you can find really good quality time to spend on it, that the only way that you can build the business or the side hustle is with leftovers, you know, your leftover time, and you pay yourself with whatever's left over, you know, after you pay all the bills and deliver all the, you know, product or services to your clients. And when you have this low level of confidence or belief that this venture that you're going into can be a viable business, it is actually important. It's not a cute hobby like some people will use to term for, you know, in order to put it down. You can always be perpetually caught into never really bringing something to a place where it can actually be a fully sustainable business venture for you. Now, some people, you know, when we start side hustles, I always tell, like, you have to have your base needs met. So it's okay to have a job and work on another business, but you have to have a belief system that that business that you're working on is going to turn into something. And that's the kitchen table business experience I have. Like, that's how I built a manufacturing company. You know, that's how the wedding businesses, you know, happened and the other ventures that I've, you know, that I've done over the last, you know, 20 some years. And so what I put in that article was I had some questions for people to ask of themselves, like, you know, do you still believe that there's no way you can ever turn this into something that can pay you a full salary? Because if you really believe that, then you're always going to perpetuate that belief through all of your behaviors, you know, and it's self-sabotage usually comes out in the form of money. You know, you aren't pricing enough, you're not selling enough, you're not setting sales targets. Again, you know, it's on the back burner only until you have a little bit of time because you'd feel bad if you spend more time or the time that's necessary for the business to come to life. And again, that comes from a deep sense of shame of, and sometimes people have been told that their really creative pursuits are silly, or they're not really good for jobs and real careers. And I'm air quoting that for the listeners, you know, and a lot of other phrases that have made people and, you know, myself included at times believe that what we really want to do and who we authentically are just isn't good enough. And that can be a trap.
I was frantically writing notes about that because I have definitely fallen into the side hustle mindset. Thank you. What's the best way to get hold of you?
The best way is, you know, go to the website, which you'll have in the podcast notes. There I have my links to my social pages that you can also find me at. But there's, you know, contact pages and, you know, places there that you can send me a message if you'd like to. I also have a lot of people that reach out to me on Instagram. So my Instagram is ame_queercony. And so you can find me there and, you know, send me a note or a message or whatever. But, you know, I'm all about transparency. So if you're curious about my coaching, you know, services, it's on there with pricing. So you don't even have to send me a message, you know, to find out what I charge. I figure that's how you build trust with people. And also the One Broken Mom podcast is a great place to at least get to know me before. If you don't want to send me a message right away, you're more than welcome to dial up some of those episodes and hear some of the things that I passionately care about and talk about.
One Broken Mom, mental health and self-improvement with a punk rock attitude. and to create, to combine authenticity with your business, to grow in your business, to become a fearless woman or a fearless leader, please reach out to Ami. Her website, I'm going to spell it AmeeQuiriconi.com. Thank you so much. I learned so much, and I am so honored that I got to spend time with you this morning. I really appreciate it, Ami.
Oh, I appreciate this as well. And, you know, any chances to be able to support what you're doing. And I appreciate your vulnerability too. And to be able to help your community with all of their pursuits. I'm here for that.
You really are. Have a lovely rest of your day. Bye.
Bye.